You're the only one I got.
What would you like us to do first? I'll give you a choice since you get the shortest time.
But how long is it gonna take to do the
I think we're at the point where we've got ready to do it.
Okay, let's do that.
I don't know what your answer is on that one.
No, let's just take the whole section.
Okay.
And that's what we proposed to them, and explain it to them and see what they want to do.
So we're taking out all that.
Yeah.
The two bills, the two other.
No, leave that in.
It's another issue.
Leave it back in.
Okay.
We're gonna take about some of the.
My consensus.
Yeah, well.
My consensus.
Okay, we'll start the judiciary committee. We're coming back into order here. This was just held over from earlier today. It's the 10th of May, 6:30 or 7:00. Representative Grover, Hanley, Miller, Martin, Ellis, and Don are here. And we were at this third amendment.
Right.
And Lori, can you explain the issue to the committee?
Okay, amendment number three is J5. That's the one that we discussed when most of the committee members were here the other day, that is changing, it's deleting an amendment that was made in the Senate bill to change automobile insurance. Existing laws, motor vehicle casualty insurance, that went to automobile insurance. The retired people feel very strongly it should say motor vehicle liability insurance. Everybody's in agreement with this amendment.
Everybody's in agreement?
The industry, the division of insurance.
So this is number three.
It's a non-controversial amendment.
Okay. No objection? It carries.
The next amendment number four is number J7. And the director has the power to assess civil penalties against, I guess, agents and brokers. That's where this provision is. Is that correct, Mr. Walsh?
Yes.
And current law, which was passed in the 70s, is $1,000 for a violation, $10,000 for continuing course of conduct. The original version of the bill raised it to $10,000 and $100,000. The brokers and agents felt that would put them out of business. We reduced it to $5,000 and $50,000. They still felt that was too high.
Yeah.
They can live with $2,500 and $25,000, and that's what this amendment does.
So
wait a second. I want to understand that.
Penalties for agents and brokers who commit strict liability offenses.
Yeah.
There's other penalties for knowing violations that are higher. This is strict liability. Current law is $1,000 and $10,000. The original version of the bill was $10,000 for a single violation, $100,000 for a continuing course of conduct. The Senate took out those amendments and went back to $1,000 and $10,000. The committee substitute that we did in recognition of inflation went up to $5,000 and $50,000. The agents and brokers feel like $50,000 in particular is more than many of them make in an entire year, that's an onerous penalty for a strict liability violation. They agree that we need to deal with inflation and these penalties, and Mr. Cruz indicated on behalf of the agents and brokers who he's representing that $2,500 and $25,000 he feels is a reasonable approach to dealing with inflation and making it be more than just a cost of doing business in terms of a penalty, but would not be so onerous as to put them actually out of business.
Mr. Chairman, has anyone ever been fined under this provision?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Martin, yes. We find people quite regularly. We wanted to work out a figure that more accurately represented the cost of doing business today. The agents and brokers are happy with that figure. We feel that it's representative of the kind of civil penalties that we assess, and so we're happy.
When would it be a deterrent?
May I inquire, Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Mr. Walsh, let's look at the language in 124, section 148. And you can see what members can see what the provisions are. This may deal with all sorts of things, from little violations by little individual brokers to giant violations by giant companies. Am I correct?
No. This section D basically is the civil penalty that goes against an individual.
So it's not against the whole brokerage house.
No. If you look at section 149. You can see that those fines have gone up substantially, and those are the essentially the company fines.
I see an upset. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll move the amendment.
Good point.
It seems fair.
All right. Is there any objection?
Objection.
Okay.
So
J8 is number 5, and this amendment we had added in. Members of this committee may recall House Bill 305. Which dealt with some issues that the insurance company had on motorcycle insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And that passed the House. It's now in Senate rules.
reason you want to do that? Are you sure, apparently the other bill is likely to pass, is that just...
Yeah, likely to pass.
Just leaving it in here is basically a certain...
Yeah, well, I'm not offering this one.
I won't offer, I think for a second.
It's 2.7.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a change on it, it's section 227, not 228.
We're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, nobody's gonna offer it unless you...
Nothing's offered.
Okay.
You still got it in there, okay.
Well, we're just gonna, I'm gonna deal with that now, that's the remaining issue. And we don't have an amendment drafted because we've been trying to figure out a way to accommodate everybody's... There's a provision in the existing bill that relates to independent boards of directors of domestic insurance companies. The original bill that came over from the Senate had a grandfather clause for domestic insurers that were in operation basically on the effective date of the act. That raises concerns because if it's good public policy to have independent boards of directors, why should it make any difference if a company's in business on December 31st or starts business on January 1st? We, as a result of those kinds of considerations, and you know, what happens if somebody sells a company that they, you know, own? It's not like an individual that you're grandfathering in. A company can change hands and actually become a different entity, although it operates under the same name. To deal with that, we put in section 227, which gave domestic insurance companies, insurers, that's the last page of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
We gave them 3 years to come into compliance so that all of a sudden today, the day the bill went into effect, they wouldn't have to dump their board of directors to comply with the independent board of directors provision. The apparently some of the existing domestic insurers feel very strongly that they should not have to comply with the independent board of directors provisions. I believe that it's the position of Mr. Walsh, and he can explain himself, that what we ought to do is just not deal with the issue in this bill, take out section 227, and take out the requirements in 2122.105 C and D, which are in section 44 of the bill, which is on page 34, lines 5 through 23. It's his position that we should leave that to a later date and just not deal with the issue in the bill because it's too controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I think he doesn't want to have that issue stop this bill. So that's my summary, and I'm sure Mr. Walsh can speak for himself.
Ms. Chairman, Ms. Otto is correct. This is a problematic section for a state like Alaska on a number of grounds. The main one, I mean, there's some philosophical ones about should the government be telling private business to do that have been raised, but the main practical consideration is that we only have 11 domestics, and every one of those domestics is very small. A number of them would find this a very difficult thing to comply with because they are small insurance companies that are essentially reciprocals or mutuals. They do not operate to offer insurance to the general public. If they have outside directors, if they're required to have outside directors, then they have to do, not only is it an additional cost to get those people, pay them honorarium, fly them to meetings, et cetera, but the real cost comes in because they have to get directors and officers liability insurance. And for a lot of our small domestics, that's a real problem. We had hoped, you know, Ms. Otto and I have been talking about this, and we've come up with a number of different alternatives. Unfortunately, within the time frame that we're now operating, we were not able to get any consensus from the domestics as to what to do. I do not believe that the deletion of the language is going to materially affect our chances for accreditation. I would like the opportunity to work with the domestics to develop something that works for them and yet complies with the requirement of a more open board of directors on insurance companies. And therefore, I would suggest that we drop the language Ms. Otto referred to on page 34 and drop section 227 completely, and we'll work that out another day.
Ms. Jones? I wouldn't mind dropping that. I think a number of years ago, we were trying to do just the opposite. We were trying to force major insurance companies to have workers up here. Now, I'd rather do that. I'm going to visit this next year. Well, considering I may be elected, but I'd rather do that. Many people have complained. We always have to deal out of Seattle or Wisconsin. I have to deal out of Montana. Whatever we can do to make them have domestic workers up here, I'd rather do it that way. We agreed to take this out until we study it more.
Is the chairman going to be sure?
I'm not. I'll look.
Okay, amendment's been moved. All those in favor? Okay, all those opposed? Record should reflect the chair voted against it. Okay, so it carries. Pardon? That's all the changes.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I'm jumping to the end.
Okay, so I think it's done. Is there any member of the public here to testify on this bill?
Oh, I have one question, excuse me.
Okay.
You said something about accreditation. Is the purpose of this to get accreditation of somebody?
Yes, through the chair, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has enacted a program of accrediting state insurance departments. For a number of reasons. The main one is that insurance regulation among the 55 U.S. insurance jurisdictions has been uneven, and that's, I think, probably an understatement. It's one criticism of the system that we have now that is very legitimate. So starting in 1986, a series of model laws were developed and approved by the association as meeting the minimum standards.
The name of the association?
National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Okay.
The body of those model laws, we feel, and I'm secretary of the organization, so I feel very strongly about the accreditation program, but we feel that these model laws provide a baseline, a minimum standard that every state ought to have.
And this includes a bunch of those model laws.
And yes, this is about half of the bill. The other half is the licensing reform that I spoke about before to allow us to go to a multi-year license. It'll cut down our turnaround time dramatically. And I think it'll allow us to do essentially more with less in terms of our service to agents and brokers and the 4,800 licenses that we regulate. But the accreditation, this bill is the last of the accreditation models. 2 years ago, the legislature passed the Guarantee Association, and very fortunately, since that bill was passed in May, and the next January or next April, I guess, executive life went down. These are the remaining models that we need.
Okay,
would
you like a motion?
Okay, motion to move the bill with individual recommendations.
This is your
bill, Is there any objection to the motion to move the bill with individual recommendations? Hearing no objection, motion carries.
Thank you. This is a bill that will generate no discussion on the floor.
Good God. Right. How'd you make out, Dave?
Huh?
Did you give it to Mama Drew?
Of course, when they have an LD discussion,
I don't
we'll
think
perpetuity.
So.
Now
we have two bills. So now I'm confused.
Yeah, 6 hours ago I asked for a
Well, it's nice to have the room cleared of the industry.
No, it was a print.
Yeah.
Oh, it's got
Who's going to have Billy up there with me?
Yeah, those guys better be there in the gallery.
Yeah, it's got
They have only got one.
Oh, they brought over. And it was a house version, so.
And they walked over.
Yeah, I've got the walk in.
Well, Max, now that we learned this afternoon how fish die, we want you to show us this evening how trees die.
I can do an imitation too.
Tweets go.
Let's see here. Change the imitation.
My change up.
Image. That's how trees die.
They call me Leatherface.
But you hear Ben, they call me Ben Mac.
Ben Mac, right.
Actually, yeah.
With trees, it's Maxie Axe.
Yeah, I'll give you a leather jacket, leather pants, a
Give him a cycle. Now that we got an insurance for a cycle,
I'll give him a cycle.
to be this benign kid.
It looks to me like we're coming back to conspiracy then here.
Okay.
Okay, so, we've got the two bills. President Parnell, I don't know if you were around much for these, but we went quite extensively.
But in the middle of Lori's, I had to go back to Labor and Commerce.
Okay, is there anybody who wants to give some public testimony on, I'd say either? Okay, is there anybody who wants to give a public testimony? Okay, staff, where we left it is you're gonna try to get ahold of some people?
Right, and I guess I can detail for you what I did. It's Sunday and it's difficult to get ahold of people. I called the public defender agency in Anchorage, nobody was there. I called the Office of Public Advocacy. I left a message with their answering service. I called the Office of Public Advocacy and left a message there for Grant McGee, who called me back, who's waiting at his home for us to call. I called the public defender agency in Juneau, nobody was there. I called Peggy Burke, who's the public defender for Juneau, and nobody was her call. She left a message to call, she hasn't called back. I called John Salenda, who's the public defender in Anchorage at home, he hasn't called back. I called Barbara, who testified for the public defender agency at home, she hasn't called back. All these places I've left messages. I called Chris Schloss and left a message, she hasn't called back. I called Jim McComas at home, he didn't have an answering machine, nobody answered the phone. I called Schloss and McComas at their office. Still the only person that we were able to locate, Grant McGee, who we have ready and willing and desirous of testifying.
Okay. So
Randall Burns is also here to testify.
Okay, could the staff set up the telephone for to teleconference, and then while they're doing that, I'd like to ask if the sponsor's representative had a chance to look at the bill yet and what their position is.
Yeah. It must be understood they all have occupied IDs. I think they all have mothers.
They all have what?
Mothers.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We do too, don't we? Okay. Yeah, please.
I'm hoping we accept my will.
Don't make them criminals.
For the record, Jeff Bullock with Senator Halford again. Senator Halford has had a chance to review the CS, and after talking with Mr. Guarnelli, is fine with it.
All right, Mr. Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there any questions for
the motion?
No, we'd like to hear the public testimony.
Before we move the bill?
Yeah, that's on.
Mr. Guarnelli, did you want to? Okay, we'll go with Mr. McGee. Hi, Mr. McGee, this is Dave Donnelly. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm here, and this is the House Judiciary Committee, and President Representative Gruenberg, Hanley, Martin, Miller, Parnell, and myself. Representative Ellis is at the Conference Committee on the Ethics Bill, so I couldn't attend. Did you want to give some testimony on these proposed conspiracy bills?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. I was located by one of your aides, and I'm caught at home, which is a blessing in disguise for you, since I don't have my notes, and so I'll necessarily be far briefer than I ordinarily would be. Would you like me to proceed with my testimony?
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chairman, the various forms of the conspiracy bill have been around for years, and it used to be touted as the answer to large-scale drug operations in that the Department of Law would be able to pursue the higher, more responsible drug kingpin than they were able to under existing law. That theory has apparently gone away since various authorities were challenged to tell legislators who got away in the past. I don't believe that any satisfactory answer to that has ever been put before the committees. Now, the Department of Law is maintaining that it will be used primarily as an additional charge, and that some savings could result as a result of joint trials. I think that the committee members should view conspiracy laws as a high-cost experiment in criminal justice litigation. In fact, the costs of passage of this bill and prosecutions under it are going to be extraordinarily high, in that we have the example on the federal side of the use of the conspiracy charge as an adjunct or additional charge, which is what law is now telling us they will do. They state that savings could result from the use of joint trials, and that may be true from the prosecution perspective, because after all, there's only one or two prosecutors in the courtroom on a joint trial. Unfortunately, it would cost additional monies for the defense. The Office of Public Advocacy is responsible for all public defender conflict cases. In other words, if there are, let's say that it's a small conspiracy and there are only five individuals involved, and let's further assume, as will necessarily be the case in probably 80 to 90% of all conspiracy defendants, they are indigent within the meaning of that term and within the within court system regulation. If that occurs, the prosecution will have one person in the courtroom. The public defender agency will represent client number one. OPA staff, if it's in an urban area, will represent client number two, and the Office of Public Advocacy will be responsible for providing counsel to each of the other three defendants in that particular case. So we will be paying four lawyers, the public defender will be paying one, and Department of Law will be paying one. In short, it's going to be very expensive to have these joint trials. Two things that I should like to add at this point, and that is that I do not believe the claim that the use of the conspiracy charge will induce pleas. There is no reason to assume that a criminal defendant would plead to a new, untested, charged crime. That is, this case is this statute, or whatever statute is passed regarding conspiracy, will be litigated vigorously from both sides, just as the federal criminal statute has been litigated since the early part of this century. There is no reason to believe that it's going to induce pleas any more than current drug charges induce pleas, simply because no one is going to plead to an untested statute. Second, it is not going to enhance penalties because most of the versions of the bills that I've seen charge conspiracy as one lesser crime than the object of the conspiracy. In short, if somebody is charged with dealing cocaine, which is typically a B felony, and if they're charged with conspiracy, they will be charged with a C felony. For sentencing purposes, both of those charges will certainly be merged. So drug defendants are unlikely to receive enhanced penalties simply because they get convicted of some additional conspiracy charge. Finally, I'd like to encourage you to consider that now, typically, drug investigations result in by-bust arrests, usually after 2 to 3 purchases from an individual. These operations are conducted in both urban and rural areas of Alaska with an undercover officer. With the addition of conspiracy, the Department of Law may find that they're able to charge, rather than 5 or 6 individuals separately, each of them for 2 to 3 incidents, they may be able to charge a conspiracy. If they charge a conspiracy, all of those cases are not going to be able to be represented by the public defender agency as they would be if they were charged separately. If they charge jointly, the conflict of interest will be created, and you'll have the additional cost of the Office of Public Advocacy having to use private sector contractors and other attorneys in order to provide representation. As you probably know, this is far more expensive than using staff attorneys from the public defender agency and from the Office of Public Advocacy. So I think that you need to consider that this is indeed a high-cost experiment and pay close attention to the fiscal notes that are attached to each of these bills by the public defender and by OPA. I'd like to add as well that the fiscal notes have little changed in the years that the conspiracy notion has been around. The only thing that has changed with respect to fiscal ramifications are the Department of Law's fiscal notes. They used to predict high costs associated with passage of the bill. They don't anymore. We have always predicted virtually the same in terms of the resources that we would need should such a bill pass. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thanks, Brent. Representative Mark.
Yeah, Mr. McGee, outside the financial aspect of it, from your point, do you think that there may be a increased public safety aspect if the citizen, will they breathe easier thinking that more of the dealers or those who conspire for motive will be put in jail? Has it shown that those states that have a conspiracy law eventually convict more of these type of crimes?
Well, I don't see how that could be true, Representative. I believe this is Representative Martin.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't understand why that would be true. Mm-hmm. And here's why. Most people who are convicted of drug charges are convicted either on wired transaction, with the undercover officer having basically a microphone with him or her at the time the transaction is done, and perhaps additional evidence to show that someone was involved in some accomplice capacity. Usually, those types of prosecutions involve turned witnesses or witnesses who have been induced in some way to turn state evidence and to testify against these individuals. I don't know how a conspiracy charge would add to the prospects for prosecution under those circumstances. It could be, but let's assume that it's true. Let's assume that that law enforcement would have a better shot at some individuals, although they certainly haven't been able to demonstrate in the years the notion has been around that anyone has gotten away from them because of the lack of a conspiracy statute. So let's assume that they're correct and that they will be able to reach out to people. Why don't they go over to federal court and ask the U.S. attorneys to prosecute using their conspiracy statute? You can't hardly violate any drug statute in this state without also violating a corresponding federal statute. From what I read in the papers, the local U.S. attorney and the district attorney's office are working very well together in other aspects, other respective caseloads. So if they do need a conspiracy statute, why not just go federal with the case? The other advantage of that is that the state doesn't have to pay for the cost of prosecution, defense, the courtroom, or perhaps most expensively, incarcerating the convicted individuals.
Well, I kind of agree with your point there. It makes me wonder why is the U.S. District Attorney constantly, no matter who it's been, but the new one, I think, is really beating the drums, insisting that we have conspiracy law.
Yeah, and Representative Martin, I can't speak for him.
Well, what can we do to make him use federal law, if anything?
Well, I don't know. I, as far as I can tell, he's not at all reluctant to use federal laws in drug cases. In fact, I believe the last time that both he and District Attorney McNally testified, they were talking about their cooperation on drug cases. So I think they are using it. I don't know. I haven't seen the case made for why the state needs a conspiracy statute. And I haven't seen it made since it first came up in the mid 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And I've certainly talked to lots of prosecutors over the years about, for example, the big issue, which for me as a citizen is, who's getting away because we don't have a conspiracy statute? I've yet to receive an answer on that. I've yet to receive an answer.
Well, this will be my last statement. Mr. McGee, I agree with what you're saying, and it seems logical. But I also know right now there's even a group that's forming that wants to do a statewide initiative on it. And it just shows that for some reason there's a public perception that we are not as protected as other states are. And maybe the other information needs to be getting out to the public.
I understand that, Representative Martin, and I understand there are strong feelings on both sides of this, and I don't envy you your job in making decisions on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thanks for your testimony. You might want to stay online. Mr. Cornelli, did you want to address the committee at all? Or
sure.
If you want to.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I can barely hear the panel.
Okay. Well, Representative Martin, maybe you could turn the phone around.
Yeah, we're going to change it around, Mr. McGee, so Mr. Cornelli, you can hear his testimony.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Cornelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Let me start out by saying that conspiracy legislation is supported by a great number of law enforcement agencies, the Alaska State Troopers, the Anchorage Police Department, the Alaska Peace Officers Association, the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, the U.S. Attorney's Office. All of those agencies believe that this is an important measure for Alaska and can be effective for Alaska law enforcement. The U.S. Attorney's Office has a very small staff. It has only about 10 or a dozen attorneys to handle all of the civil and criminal work for the United States government in the state of Alaska. We cannot rely on the United States Attorney's Office to do our work for us. In addition, this conspiracy law covers things like murder, for which there are not adequate federal laws to cover strictly street murders. The federal law will cover things like murders committed with mail bombs and that sort of thing, where there's a federal connection, but our law, this proposed law, would cover other crimes the U.S. Attorney's Office cannot prosecute. So we are the only ones who are able to prosecute that. The points that Mr. McGee made are primarily financial. Those points were made in the Senate Judiciary, also in Senate Finance, and the fiscal notes for both the public defender and public advocate were zeroed out in Senate Finance on the motion of Senator Adams.
How much had they been?
They were on the order of about $500,000 each for each agency.
Court system has about 300,000.
That was just zeroed out too.
I don't recall that one. I believe all the fiscal notes were.
You good about the house?
That means you're not going to prosecute? Not going to defend?
I think that they, like other agencies, will do what is they can within their resources. Let me just make one thing very clear in response to the representative from the ACLU, and that is that this law does not penalize speech, or free speech. It does not criminalize expressions of feelings and ideas, as Mr. Burns indicated. It may be said that making obscene phone calls is the expression of feelings and ideas, but that's something that's criminal under Alaska law, and it doesn't impinge upon the First Amendment. There are a number of laws under our criminal statutes that involve speech, making death threats, falsely accusing a legislator of ethical violations, making false reports. All of those.
We need to get that in the conference committee.
All of those things involve speech in some way or another, yet they are crimes under Alaska law. What this involves is not merely talking about a crime, not merely agreeing that a crime be committed, but that actually some step be taken to do something, taking some overt act that manifests an intent to commit that crime. What happens in conspiracies, and one of the underlying philosophies behind conspiracy, is that once the discussion progresses to that point where there's been an agreement and somebody actually does something, that things get beyond the control, perhaps, of either participant. The participants split up, they each have certain things that they're going to do, and it makes it much more likely that the crime will be committed, and makes it much less likely that it can be stopped. There's a certain amount of danger in joint cooperation between two people in committing a crime. There was testimony in this committee and in other committees that this law can be abused. I think any law can be abused, but I have not seen any indication that this attorney general or any of the five attorneys general that I have served under before him have allowed any systematic widespread abuse of the Alaska criminal laws. In addition, the proposed changes made by this committee would restrict some of the abuses that have been talked about. For example, a person under this committee version cannot be convicted of the if the offense is actually completed, they cannot be convicted of the completed offense and the conspiracy. If there is a conspiracy to commit 10 crimes, there can only be a conviction for one conspiracy. You can't be convicted for 10 conspiracies. Those are some provisions that will guard against some of the abuses that you have heard about. I think one of the cases that grabs some headlines, where at least at the federal level, where a conspiracy was put into use, was Augustus and Sheely mail bombing. I mean, you had some individuals in prison. I mean, they certainly didn't do the crime themselves, but there was joint action between them, discussions between them, and conspiracy was certainly appropriate under those circumstances, and I think that it would be appropriate under other circumstances as well. We therefore believe that this is an appropriate bill. We have no objection to the changes made by this committee. I've spoken with the Attorney General and with representatives from the Department of Environmental Conservation about the particular applicability to environmental crimes, and there's no opposition to those changes.
Mr. Bonilla, does the Attorney General of this administration support the bill?
Yes, he does.
Did the Attorney General of the last administration?
I don't recall whether in the very last administration. I'll let Ms. Otto respond to that. I honestly don't recall.
I actually did work on the conspiracy bills, and the official position of the administration was neutrality on whether or not the legislature should adopt it under both Attorney General Deb Bailey and Attorney General Greg Schiavo, although both of those two attorneys general raised a number of substantive concerns about the legislation. But at bottom, they said it's a legislative decision whether or not you're going to make it against the law, although they did have concerns.
Do you know how long it's been since any other administration actively supported
I don't believe that the administrations immediately before that did.
I don't recall previous administrations supporting that.
And I don't recall, frankly, which crimes previous versions applied to. There were some versions many years ago that applied to a wide range of crimes. Other versions applied to crimes that perhaps weren't inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's been one that has been crafted as narrowly as this one.
Any further questions?
Have you checked with the Attorney General to find out whether the Attorney General supports the bill with the inclusion of conspiracy for environmental violations?
I did, and the Attorney General's feeling was that to the extent that that environmental, that conspiracies to commit environmental offenses were punishable under federal law, that he did not see a problem with Alaska law being consistent.
Well, how about there are some crimes in Alaska law that are not crimes under federal law,
Well, that may be. I'm not that familiar with the environmental offenses, but...
One of the effects of a conspiracy is if the underlying offense, and I don't recall this bill, does this bill contain the provision that if you conspire to commit an offense that is in itself a misdemeanor, that the conspiracy raises it to a felony?
That would be the, that may be the result under federal law, it is not the result under this bill. It would be an even lower level of felony in most cases.
But how about if the underlying crime, does this apply to underlying crimes that are misdemeanors?
The environmental offenses do, yes.
And if you conspire to commit a crime that is itself a misdemeanor, what is the penalty for conspiracy under this bill?
It is also a misdemeanor.
Is it the same level of misdemeanor?
In most instances, it's one level less.
Did you make a motion?
No, not that I heard.
Oh.
We need to do something before.
But what did you say?
He said, are you making a motion? And I said,
Oh, no. We need to make an amendment. Lori, did you
want
to check?
Right, and it's exactly on this point. If you look
this
on...
This one formally in front of it?
Yeah, 554
before us.
The same amendment's going to be...
554?
No,
that would be
554 before us. 554, and that's what Lori's speaking.
It's going to be the same amendment in both of them.
Page?
On page 554, page 3. And this is where we're going down and saying we're dropping the penalty for conspiracy, just like we do for attempt, one class lower than the substantive crime. But I think the drafter got confused that I didn't accurately convey in the drafting instructions. When you get down to page 3, line 24 and 25, it should say a Class C felony if the object of the conspiracy is the crime punishable as a Class B felony, and then a new 5 that says a Class A misdemeanor if the object of the conspiracy is a crime punishable as a Class C felony.
Yeah, there's
and
a
that's
whole
just an over that's just yeah. an oversight.
Okay.
So
I'll move that amendment. Any objection? Hearing no objection, amendment stop it. Okay. So are we ready to move 554 and then we'll do the same amendment?
No, I have one question.
Okay.
If we move the House bill on rather than the Senate vehicle that we have.
Well, my intent is to move both.
Oh, because I'm looking at something being done this year.
Yeah. My intent is to move both.
Are you looking for a motion to move 554?
I'm looking for a motion to move 554.
Mr. Chairman, I would move 554 judiciary as amended.
Okay. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Okay. Now, bring up 343, and we need to make that same amendment.
Right. And there it would be on page 3. It would be lines 2 to 3, and then after line 3, adding in Class C felony if the object of conspiracy crime punishable as a Class B felony, and then Class C misdemeanor as a Class C felony.
Okay, I'll make that motion. Any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. All right. Is there any further discussion? Are we ready to move this one? Okay, motion to move the bill with individual recommendations and CS as amended. Any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Okay. I was hoping Representative Ellis would be back in case the person has the biggest concern with this 3-4. Yeah. I gave you, I don't think we're going to be moving unless he's present because he's got some serious concerns about it. But if you want to address the committee, you're welcome to, and we can start some work.
What bill is it?
340, which isn't out before the members, but maybe we can pass it out as long as we've got some time.
Did you read it over?
This is just a conceptual.
Hand out the bill or pass the bill out to the committee?
We're going to have staff hand out the bill documents for Senate Bill 340. We'll have a presentation from the sponsor, but it's not the chair's intent to move it without Reverend Ellis being present.
I need to run
to the list.
Sure.
I've got
to
keep
running
on the list.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I need to welcome you at my, at the subcommittee meeting.
Yeah, I think that's where...
They were going to meet at 7.
Okay. Did you already sign his mic?
Yeah, I signed it.
I don't want Mr. McGee to hear.
Mr. McGee? Oh, yeah. Did we say right? Hard to remember that they're around.
Mr. Chairman, I've been a visit to necessary, too. I've already reviewed this in the Commerce, and I actually have a suggested amendment upstairs on the floor of the House.
don't think there'd be any problem with you offering it on the floor.
I'd rather let these guys drag it around.
I'm over with individual.
Well, I guess I can learn about it, and you can learn about it next.
Sure. Well, now, yeah, and Mark had a question about it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee and staff. I'm Dale Staley, staff to Senator Duncan, prime sponsor of Senate Bill 340. Briefly, what Senate Bill 340 proposes to do is amend Chapter 10, Employment Practices and Working Conditions, section of Title 23, by explicitly prohibiting that an employer may not discriminate against an applicant or employee with respect to compensation, privileges, terms, or conditions of employment as a result of the individual's use of lawful products in lawful manner during non-working hours in places other than the premises or vehicles of the employer and when not wearing or carrying clothing or other items that would identify the individual as an employee of that employer. Further, it provides that it is not unlawful or unfair for an employer to discharge or disadvantage an employee or individual with respect to compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment when based on the employee's failure to meet specific job performance standards. It's not unlawful or unfair for an employer to offer, impose, or to have in effect a health, disability, or insurance policy with differential coverage for employees based on the employee's use of legal products. And if the insurance has differential premium rates, the employer shall provide a written statement of the rates to the employees. The measure provides that this section would not apply to religious organizations and further defines employee as a person employed by the employer and defines employer as a person, the state, or political subdivision who employs 10 or more persons in Alaska. I'd be welcome to try to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman,
uh-huh.
I would like Martin. I would like you to, if Mark Handley could come up to the table
sure.
and explain to Dale and the rest of us his concern, and I think it's a real legitimate one.
For the record, it's Mark Handley, staff representative. I just, you know, mentioned that there is a policy. It's called closed camp policy in the wildland fire suppression manual that both the state and the federal government use in the state. And they don't allow people to drink when they're basically under hire by the federal or state government. Use of alcohol, they close the camp usually, but, you know, basically use of alcohol, regardless of whether the person becomes intoxicated, possession of alcohol in the fire camps, which aren't usually the premises of the employer, a lot of times it's on the premises of either the federal or state government or private lands, is grounds for immediate termination. And I just wondered whether this may or may not cause problems for enforcing that policy. Because it's usually fairly acrimonious type of situation when employees are discharged, it's often grounds for some kind of litigation.
I think that's legitimate.
And when you're answering that, how does that apply to the North Slope, where people go up to those kind of work camps up there, and there's a policy of no alcohol?
That activity or potential activity, the employer would have the right to either not hire or to discharge that employee.
Well, yeah, but that's not. There's existing rules prohibiting from having any alcohol, nothing to do with their job, having any alcohol in those kind of camps. How does this bill relate to those kind of rules?
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, Mr. Handley has to go and testify on the Exxon bills, but please answer. He's not leaving because he's not interested.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would guess that those rules would not be able to stand with the passage.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good bill. I support it. I would like it, if it's agreeable with you, Mr. Chairman, that overnight you work, Dale, with Mark Handley and see if we come up with some language that makes it real clear that those kinds of situations, including the North Slope, including the fire suppression people, can stand. So they don't have to justify them by saying, that your ability is going to be impaired. That's a policy, and it's a legitimate policy. And I'd like it to be very clear on this. Would you work with my staff to prepare the bill?
Would be more than happy to.
And we'll help to make sure that the bill moves along.
However, Mr. Chairman, not being an attorney, but I would guess that we might be infringing on someone's right and creating two classes of persons here, based on their location or type.
Then you have bigger fish to fry than Arlen.
I'm just saying that if that kind of language were written into this, I believe that would be the problem created with that.
Yeah, but if you don't, then these people are going to have a legitimate thing with the gentleman's home.
Huh. That again would depend on their potential employer or employer's preference and foresight.
I suggest that you work on it with more concern than the people who are interested in it, you know, because it's a very, you know, you do not want those people to be up in arms about this on either the North Slope. You can leg it with the fire suppression.
Oh, I understand. Nor Alaska Airlines is saying that.
You bet. You bet. Nor Exxon shipping.
Oh,
they're not
calling it
AMI. I don't think we have anything more to do.
We can
I'm going to go. We're going to work on an amendment.
Okay, well then I guess the meeting's over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Okay. Mark is very interested in it.